This is Kathy coming to you with the Pantograph for Monday, the 9th of February, and we may pop back and pick up some of the Sunday information also. This headline reads, Illinois adopts pediatric vaccine plan. State backs academy over new CDC advice, Lisa Schenker. Illinois will adopt the childhood vaccine schedule recently released by the American Academy of Pediatrics in a rejection of federal recommendations. The move is the latest example of Illinois breaking with the federal government over health care policies and guidance since President Donald Trump took office. The Trump administration has spent the last year revamping health care policy, such as by recommending fewer vaccines for children and pulling out of the World Health Organization. While Donald Trump and Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. undermine science, spread dangerous vaccine misinformation, and put countless lives at risk, my administration is forging a different path, one that puts our people first, Governor J.B. Pritzker said in a news release Thursday. With key insights from the Illinois Immunization Advisory Committee, we're endorsing clear, evidence-based immunization schedules to help keep Illinois families safe as the federal government chooses conspiracy theories over American lives. The American Academy of Pediatrics vaccine schedule is the same as what Illinois already recommends. Last year, Illinois adopted an older federal childhood vaccine schedule from before the Trump administration began making changes. But the Illinois Department of Public Health Director Dr. Samir Vohra said Wednesday during a meeting of the state's Immunization Advisory Committee that because the new year and the federal government keeps making changes, it was important to revisit the recommendations to clear up any confusion over where Illinois stands. The American Academy of Pediatrics childhood vaccine schedule differs from the new federal recommendations in a number of ways, largely sticking to previous guidelines. The Academy, for example, continues to recommend routine flu vaccinations, broad vaccination to protect against meningococcal disease, hepatitis B vaccines for all infants, and COVID-19 vaccines for all children from the ages of 6 to 23 months, whereas the new federal schedule does not, instead leaving it up to parents and doctors whether to vaccinate individual children in most cases. The American Academy of Pediatrics released its schedule last month after the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention dramatically reduced the number of vaccines it recommends for children. A dozen prominent medical groups, including the Chicago-based American Medical Association, have thrown their support behind the Academy's schedule. The Academy had criticized new federal recommendations as a departure from long-standing medical advice evidence. Meanwhile, federal officials said the new CDC schedule came after a review of other countries' vaccine practices and the scientific evidence behind them, conducted at the instruction of Trump. The updated CDC childhood schedule continues to protect children against serious diseases while aligning U.S. guidance with international norms, said the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services said in a statement Thursday. Many peer nations achieve high vaccination rates without mandates. By relying on trust, education, and a strong doctor-patient relationships, and HHS will work with states and clinicians to ensure that families have clear, accurate information to make their own informed decisions. The statement also said Democrat-led states that impose unscientific school closures, toddler mask mandates, and vaccine passports during the COVID era are the ones who destroyed public trust and public health and should not be guiding policy. Illinois' decision to adopt the Academy's vaccine schedule came a day after the Illinois Immunization Advisory Committee met to discuss the dueling vaccine schedules. That committee voted to recommend the state adopt the Academy's vaccine schedule after many committee members expressed dismay at the new federal schedules. The new federal schedule is very stripped down, said the committee chair, Dr. Marielle Francione, with Rush University System for Health during the meeting Wednesday. She said the new federal schedule is lacking in many areas, such as by leaving out a number of high-risk groups that should be getting vaccines to protect against meningococcal disease, an illness caused by bacteria that can infect the brain lining, spinal cord, and bloodstream. The new federal guidelines no longer recommend broad vaccination to protect against meningococcal disease, instead recommending it only for kids in a certain high-risk groups, and saying it should be up to parents and doctors whether to vaccinate individual children who are not at high risk. This goes against all standards of care. It goes against our oaths as physicians. It goes against epidemiology, and it goes against science, Friccioni said, of the missing high-risk groups. Dr. Arcana Chatterjee, a committee member, recounted a story at the meeting about how her daughter caught rotavirus as an infant and had to be hospitalized. The illness can cause diarrhea and vomiting, especially in young children. The Academy schedule continues to recommend rotavirus vaccines for all infants, whereas the federal schedule says it should be left up to parents and doctors whether to give the shots to babies. Chatterjee said her daughter is now grown and doing great, but she said she told the story to emphasize the importance of the vaccine. These are real things that actually impact families, said Chatterjee, who is dean of the Chicago Medical School at Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. This impacts everyone, and it is not just the deaths that we want to focus on. Illinois' decision to adopt the Academy's vaccine schedule is one of a series of recent moves by the state that part ways with federal public policy, health policy. Earlier this week, Illinois announced that it was joining a network of the World Health Organization in hopes of better positioning the state to respond to emerging health threats after the federal government withdrew from the organization. Illinois also broke with the federal vaccine recommendations last year, deciding to continue to recommend hepatitis B vaccines for nearly all newborns and to continue to recommend COVID-19 vaccines for all children ages 6 to 23 months. Pritzker signed a bill into law last year formally establishing a process for the state to issue its own vaccine guidelines after Kennedy, a longtime vaccine skeptic, fired and replaced all the members of the Federal Vaccine Advisory Committee. State-regulated insurance plans are required to cover vaccines recommended by the state, and at this point, all the vaccines recommended by the state continue to be covered by private insurance plans, Medicaid, and the Vaccines for Children program, according to the state health department. On duty, Hudson native in the Army promoted to colonel, Stelzenberg, Germany. Paul Hester was recently promoted to the rank of colonel in the U.S. Army effective December 19, 2025. U.S. Army Colonel Hester is a Hudson native and 1998 graduate of Normal West High School. He currently serves as the Force Health Protection Officer at Medical Readiness Command in Europe. His career has spanned from veterinary medicine to environmental science with multiple combat tours. His Army journey began after graduating from Iowa State University with a doctorate in veterinary medicine. He was commissioned as a captain in the Veterinary Corps and served as a Veterinary Corps officer at Fort Riley, Kansas from 2006 to 2008. In 2008, he voluntarily reclassified as a Medical Service Corps officer and began his first tour as an Environmental Science and Engineering officer in Camp Henry, Korea, with the U.S. Army's 19th Sustainment Command. From 2009 to 2011, he served as a project officer with Public Health Command West at Fort Lewis, Washington. In 2011, Hester deployed to Afghanistan with the 1st Brigade, 25th Infantry Division. During his deployment, he suffered severe injuries in a blast. After a short period of recovery at home, where he met his newborn son, Mark, for the first time, he returned to Kandahar in southern Afghanistan. Upon returning to Afghanistan, his then-company commander, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Winnie, reduced his battlefield circulation to a minimum, out of precaution for his safety. Following his deployment, Hester's career took him to Alaska, where he served as the Chief of Environmental Health and Chief of Industrial Hygiene at Medical Department Activity in Alaska from 2012 to 2014. In 2014, he took command of the 154th Medical Detachment Preventive Medicine at Camp Walker, Korea. From 2016 to 2019, he served as the Chief of Environmental Health Engineering and Chief of Health Risk Management at Public Health Command Europe. Hester then returned to the U.S. to serve as an instructor and later an assistant professor at the Army Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Before his current assignment, Hester returned to Landstuhl, Germany, to serve as the Director of Environmental Health Sciences at Public Health Command Europe. Hester is married to Carlene Weitzel of Ames, Iowa. They have four children and currently reside in Stetzelburg, Germany. Hester's parents, Elaine and Norm Hester, reside in Normal. State AG wins first civil hate crime case, by Janice Weichert. Amid a flurry of lawsuits filed in federal court against the Trump administration, Attorney General Kwame Raoul's office won a historic first in Illinois last month by successfully trying the state's first civil hate crime lawsuit. Chad Hampton and his mother, Cheryl Hampton, who are white, were found to have engaged in intimidation and disorderly conduct towards their neighbor, Gregory Johnson, who is black, according to Raoul's office. The Hamptons allegedly lynched an effigy of Johnson facing his home after Johnson had called the police on Chad Hampton for allegedly damaging his lawn. Court filings show the Hamptons also displayed a racial slur, swastikas, and a Confederate flag aimed at their neighbor's home. "This behavior is shocking, racist, and un-American. I appreciate the judge's order that shows such despicable behavior will not be tolerated in our state," Raoul said in the release. The Attorney General's office was first given authority to try such a case in 2018. The legislature amended the Illinois Hate Crime Act to allow the Attorney General to file civil lawsuits against residents for alleged hate crimes. Carroll County Circuit Court Judge Jerry Kane ordered the Hamptons to each pay a civil penalty of $5,000 and damages of $45,000 to Johnson. The lawsuit, filed in 2022, details a record of behavior Raoul says was aimed at intimidating Johnson dating back to 2020. At the time of the incidents, the Hamptons and Johnson resided in Carroll County in northwest Illinois. Johnson had repeatedly contacted the local police department in Savannah, Illinois, about the Hamptons' aggressive conduct toward him, the lawsuit says, stating that Johnson accused Chad Hampton of damaging his lawn with weed killer. After Hampton was charged with a misdemeanor for the damage, the launched effigy appeared in the Hamptons' front yard, which Raoul labeled as an intimidation tactic and threat of racial violence in his complaint. Hate crimes in Illinois have been on the rise since 2016, but spiked in the last 4 years, according to FBI data, collected from college, city, county, state, and federal agencies. Over 50% of reported hate crimes were due to race or ethnicity. Reports of hate crimes have increased across the nation as well, according to the FBI data. "With dramatic increases in reported hate crimes, I will continue to use all of the tools at my disposal to prosecute hate crimes and send the message that hate has no place in Illinois," Raoul said in a statement. There's a photograph with this article. Mansion marks Abe's 213th birthday. Normal's Tom Miller meets with Abraham Lincoln. Portrayed by Randy Duncan on Saturday, February 7th, during Abraham Lincoln's birthday celebration at the David Davis Mansion in Bloomington, commemorating the president's 213th birthday. And they're shaking hands. The nation's 16th president visited the home of his old friend David Davis in Bloomington on Saturday to celebrate Mr. Lincoln's 213th birthday. Families were invited to sit with Abraham Lincoln, portrayed by impersonator Randy Duncan, in the parlor of the David Davis Mansion to hear stories about his time as a lawyer in the 8th Judicial Circuit, which covered most of central Illinois, including McLean County. Visitors also heard stories about Lincoln's early life, including the first and only time he ever killed an animal for food. "A young Abraham had the permission to use his father's gun," he said, "and used it to shoot a turkey that was outside their home. The boy was so distraught, he never again picked up a gun." Lincoln also spent some time as a judge in place of Davis, he said, showing his fellow lawyers belief in his strict adherence to the law and impartiality. The David Davis Mansion is open from 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., Wednesday through Saturday. The mansion is maintained by the Division of Historic Sites of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. Pritzker issues a bleak budget report. "Tremendous uncertainty looms as feds enact or threaten funding cuts," by Jerry Nowicki and Ben Salzinski. With Governor J.B. Pritzker's annual budget address less than 2 weeks away, a new report from his office is setting the table for a speech that's likely to be bleak in tone. And it's likely to serve as a warning to lawmakers and advocates that the state doesn't have room for new spending programs in the upcoming 2027 fiscal year. And it's likely to serve as a warning to lawmakers and advocates that the state doesn't have room for new spending programs in the upcoming 2027 fiscal year. The report's message, enacted or threatened federal funding cuts are creating tremendous uncertainty even in the current fiscal year. Unlike the federal government, all states, including Illinois, are required to annually balance their budgets and have limited, if any, options to fill gaps left by these federal reductions, the report from the Governor's Office of Management and Budget stated. The Governor's Office also put direct dollar amounts on some of the impending federal policy changes or cuts. First, $100 million over 2 years to implement administrative changes related to new Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and Medicaid requirements. Next, $80 million annually as a result of the federal government shifting a greater share of SNAP administrative costs. Next, $705 million in new benefits spending on SNAP if Illinois exceeds newly created error rate caps. Next, $6.1 billion in cumulative lost revenue for Medicaid, $3.8 billion of which is lost federal support by fiscal year 2033 due to caps on provider taxes. Impacts would be first felt in the fiscal year 2028 and would ramp up over the following years. $1 billion in child care related funding in fiscal year 2027 if the courts allow the administration's funding freeze to take effect. A judge on Friday issued a preliminary injunction blocking the freeze from taking immediate effect, decoupling child care. The culprit for the known variables is largely H.R. 1, widely publicized as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act in October. The governor's office warned that it could erase $830 million in tax revenue for the current fiscal year, but state lawmakers acted to decouple the federal and state tax code in certain areas their fall veto session, and the report now expects that to reduce the current impact to about $587 million. Pritzker also directed state agencies to hold back $482 million in current year spending last month. The impact of tax code changes would be less in the upcoming fiscal year because the largest current year impact was due to the acceleration of certain tax benefits forward, according to the report. But as of Friday morning when the report was published, there was also a major unknown variable. The Trump administration has threatened to freeze $1 billion in child care-related funding to Illinois and another $9 billion to several other blue states. Ostensibly, the administration said it was seeking to root out fraud without making specific allegations, although the affected states argued the amount of paperwork required for the child care funds to be released presented them with an intentionally impossible task. A federal judge on Friday issued a preliminary injunction blocking the freeze from taking effect as the full case plays out. Previously, the courts had issued 2 2-week restraining orders, creating an added level of uncertainty in the run-up to the budget address that Pritzker is slated to deliver on February 18th. Existing budget shortfalls. The report notably didn't touch on fiscal pressures related to the structural shortfalls in ongoing revenue compared to expenditures in Illinois' budget. GOMB's October report pegged the FY27 deficit at $2.2 billion if lawmakers didn't make any changes to spending or taxing policies, noting much of the deficit was driven by the state's own policies but exacerbated by federal changes. The baseline projections show revenue is not expected to grow in FY27 without lawmakers finding a way to increase it. At the same time, spending was on track to increase by about $1.9 billion from the current fiscal year without changes. Federal funding allotments are already showing signs of falling short in FY26, according to the January report from the General Assembly's Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability. Federal payments to Illinois were down $169 million last month compared to January of 2025, a decline of nearly 36%. While COGFA's experts caution that federal receipts are typically one of the state's most volatile revenue sources because they arrive in an inconsistent schedule, January marked the third straight month of decline. Federal receipts are now down to $202 million, or 8%, so far this fiscal year. The FY26 budget assumed a notable rise in federal sources this fiscal year, so significant improvement is needed over the remaining 5 months to reach initial budget expectations for this category of revenues, the report said. Despite indications the federal government is sending less money to the state, other sources such as income and sales tax continue to increase, and revenue is up 3.5% so far in FY26. Protesters gather with goods for Minnesota, by Jack Alkire. Roughly 300 people gathered Saturday on the south lawn of the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts to protest the Trump administration and gather necessities for residents of Minneapolis. The event was organized by Bloomington Normal 50501, a nonpartisan civil rights group tied to a national 50501, the central chapter of the ACLU, Prairie Pride Coalition, Latinos United for Change, and Immigrants' Rights and Social Justice Team of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Bloomington Normal. The Reverend Rebecca Gant of Unitarian Universalist Church was recently invited to Minneapolis with a group of clergy members. She spoke to the crowd Saturday about sitting with community leaders in Minnesota as they discussed ways to support one another amid the continued immigration crackdown. Gant also led the crowd in a resistance song that she learned in Minneapolis. Olenka Moss, an organizer with Bloomington Normal 50501, collected non-perishable goods and necessities like hygiene products, which she is going to take to Minneapolis this coming Saturday. To donate, Moss at blownohelps, B-L-O-N-O helps, at gmail.com. Trips to the dentist now and then. Do you enjoy your trip to the dentist? It's not a question one would normally expect to hear. In this case, though, coming from my daughter, who's had exactly one cavity in her whole life, as well as perfect teeth thanks to braces a while ago, the question was actually quite sincere. She has no idea. I have, in fact, had a few dentist appointments lately, which brought to mind a few appointments from the distant past. Just after we moved to Normal in the early 1970s, Mom decided we needed to find a regular dentist. I don't remember some of the details of why exactly we went then, but I rather think it was of the checkup variety. What I do remember is sitting in an ancient chair in an office with equipment that looked like it had been around since the turn of the century, with an old man who looked like he bought the equipment upon starting his career as a dentist. Now, a 10 or 11-year-old sometimes has a hard time guessing an adult's real age, but he looked and acted decades older than my mom, so I'm guessing he was much closer to retirement age than middle-aged. I'm sure he had plenty of experience in dentistry and practices that hadn't changed much since he first started out. At the end of the checkup, we left with Mom nearly in tears, upset that the dentist informed her that I had about 220 cavities, or so it seemed to me, and that I would have no teeth and needed dentures by the age of 22. After a few days to calm down and discussion with Dad, the first appointments were made for me, with no input from me, I might add. Not surprisingly, after just a couple of visits, suddenly we were done. Turns out, most of the cavities were just blemishes or minor problems or other issues that could wait for months or years. But for those first few visits, they were terrifying enough. I don't recall who administered the Novocaine, the doctor or the dental assistant, but whomever it was either would give too much or too little. I was either totally numb in the face or hardly numb at all. Back then, they didn't have those little suction devices that they have now, or at least this dentist didn't have them. A tiny little porcelain sink would be swung around in front of me and I would be told to spit into it. My face, mouth, and lips are so numbed up that I couldn't feel them even if I hit myself, and now you're asking me to spit into this tiny little sink? On top of that, the amount of blood and other gunk I'm spitting out while aiming is the general direction of that sink is distressing enough. After that, the dental assistant gives me a small glass of water to rinse and spit again, while I desperately try not to dribble the whole glass onto my shirt. Meanwhile, the dentist fires up his drill. Opening my mouth as wide as I can, I pray for two things, that he drills the correct tooth and also not to drill a hole in my cheek, as I had heard some rumors of it happening sometimes, at least according to the playground chatter. Nowadays, the dentist will give strict instructions to raise my left hand if I feel any pain, and they will cease action immediately. Back then, it was a given that pain was going to happen, and it did. I mentioned at the beginning of this column that I have visited the dentist a few times lately thanks to an old Tootsie Roll. I noticed a crunching sound while chewing a Tootsie Roll a couple of months ago and figured I better spit it out and see what was causing the sound. I first thought the Tootsie Roll had crystallized somehow, but soon learned that one of my teeth had essentially disintegrated, and I had a hole in the back of my mouth where a tooth was supposed to be. There was no pain, and it was out of sight, and it didn't really affect me much. I realized that I had reached 62 3/4 years of age before I lost my first adult tooth. Ha! Take that, you old dentist. No dentures for me. After a few weeks, I finally went to the dentist because I had some pain and found out a root canal and crown were my immediate future. That's okay, because the dentist practices and equipment today have improved so much there's hardly any pain or discomfort at all. They have really made the visits, even root canals, pain-free. except for the checkout time, and then there's a big pain, but only in the wallet area. And that column was written by Tom Horseth, who's lived in Normal and went through elementary through high school in Unit 5. His wife is a native of Normal and an Illinois State University graduate, but they live in Minnesota now, coincidentally living less than a mile away from a fellow Normal Community High School graduate from the same year. This article is not from Bloomington, but it's in the paper and it's interesting. Community Rallies for Restaurant Owners by Jeff Mulville. Collingswood, New Jersey. The shawarma, falafel wraps, and baklava, Jersey kebab, are great, but many of its patrons are there because these days for a side of protest. A New Jersey suburb of Philadelphia rallied around the restaurant's Turkish owner since federal officers detained the couple last February because they say their visas expired. In fact, business is so good since Salal and Ermine Eminet were picked up early in the Trump administration's immigration crackdown that they moved to a bigger space in the next town over. The regulars don't seem to mind. Family came to the U.S. seeking freedom. Salal Eminet, 52, first came to the U.S. in 2000 to learn English while he pursued his doctorate in Islamic history at a Turkish university. He returned in 2008 to serve as an imam at a southern New Jersey mosque, bringing Emine and their first two children. Two more would be born in the U.S. Before long, Salal had an additional business of delivering bread to diners. The family applied for permanent residency and believed they were on their way to receiving green cards. When the COVID-19 pandemic began and the delivery trucks were idled, Salal and Ermine, who both worked in restaurants in Turkey, opened Jersey Kebab in Haddon Township. Business was strong from the start. It all changed from a moment. On February 25th, U.S. Marshals and Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers arrested the couple at the restaurant. Salal was sent home with an ankle monitor, but Emine, now 47, was removed to a detention facility more than an hour's drive away and held there for 15 days. With its main cook in detention and the family in crisis, the shop temporarily closed. Though the area is heavily Democratic, the Eminet's arrests signaled to many residents that immigration enforcement during President Donald Trump's second term wouldn't stop at going after people with criminal backgrounds who are in the U.S. illegally. They're not dangerous people, not the people we were told on TV they were looking for to remove from our country, Haddon Township Mayor Randy Teague said. Supporters organized a vigil and raised $300,000 that kept the family and business afloat while the shop was closed and paid legal bills. Members of Congress helped, and hundreds of customers wrote letters of support. Space for a crowd. As news of the family's ordeal spread, customers new and old began to pack the restaurant. The family moved it late last year to a bigger space down busy Haddon Avenue in Collingswood. They added a breakfast menu and for the first time needed to hire service besides their own son, Muhammad. The location changed, but the restaurant still features a sign in the window offering free meals to people in need. That's honoring a Muslim value, to care for anybody who has less than us, Muhammad said. Judy Kubit and Linda Ray, two friends from the nearby communities of Medford and Columbus, respectively, said they came to Haddon Township last year for an anti-Trump No Kings rally and ate a post-protest lunch at the kebab shop. We thought we have to go in just to show our solidarity for the whole issue. Last month, with the immigration crackdown in Minneapolis dominating the headlines, they were at the new location for lunch. The Eminets desperately want to stay in the U.S., where they've built a life and raised their family. Salal has a deportation hearing in March, and Ermine and Muhammad will also have hearings eventually. Salal said moving back to Turkey would be bad for his younger children. They don't speak Turkish, and one is autistic and needs the help available in the U.S. He'd also be worried about his own safety because of his academic articles. I am in opposition to the Turkish government, he said. If they deport me, I'm going to get very big problems. The groundswell of support showed the Eminets they are not alone. We're kind of fighting for our right to stay the country, Muhammad Eminet said, while still having amazing support from the community behind us. So we're all in it together. And I think I'll stop right there. Please stay tuned for part two coming up shortly.